And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to go on a journey carried on the words of a man who, along with his wife and fellow adventurer, set out on a 1,000-mile quest from the wild lands of Canada to the calving grounds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as they follow the porcupine caribou herd on their annual migration. If you care about ANWR or the wilds and wonders that penetrate us all, then get ready for the journey of a lifetime when your voice of the earth continues on this special edition of the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to hear one of the most amazing stories of adventure of the 21st century. In April 2003, Carsten Hoyer and his bride Leanne set out on an Arctic trek to follow the legendary porcupine caribou herd from the wintering grounds in northern Canada, over 500 miles of frozen trails, biting blizzards, grizzlies, in a test of human endurance, to find out what being caribou really is. The story drives home to our modern world, better than any of recent times, why the preservation of the calving areas located on the coastal tundra of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge must be recognized and held sacred for the soul of the wild creatures, who will tell us their story as enacted each year for the past 27,000 years through this amazing story of being caribou. This is a special edition of the Wild Side News. I empower you to come along during the next 2 hours so that you too can come to know what being caribou is all about. And so the journey begins. Today I was listening to the President speak about the emerging global war on terror, and it just seems sometimes that the stresses of our world are overwhelming at times, and the challenges are enormous, and it's hard to find our way. And even the global war on terror oftentimes can be associated with, at least according to some people, the demands that are being placed on our future for issues such as oil in particular. And these issues then translate right into the ground here, including stresses potentially on places like ANWR, where oil becomes the issue, quite honestly, at least from the perspective of our own national security. And so the answers to these questions become very complex. And sometimes it's very hard to find our way. But every once in a while, a person emerges who decides to challenge these kinds of future visions with a whole different way of looking at things and trying to find out different levels of truth. And joining us today is an extraordinary person, Carsten Hoyer, who has written a book recently called Being Caribou, just out by the great people at Mountaineers Books. Carsten, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks a lot, Sydney.
Being Caribou is a story of an adventure that you and your wife took on, where you decided that you were going to find out what it meant to be caribou, and we're going to talk at length about that. But first, let's talk a little bit about you and your background that kind of helped to lead to this extraordinary challenge. So give us a background on kind of, first of all, about your career and your experience.
Sure. So right now I'm living in Canada. We live in British Columbia, sort of north central. On one side of the valley where we live is the Canadian Rockies, and on the other side is the Caribou Mountains. And through the course of the last 10 years of my life, I've taken my biological training, so my degree in ecology, and applied it both to work in wildlife biology in countries as far and wide as Slovakia and Poland and South Africa, and as close as to home as Jasper National Park and Banff National Park in Alberta, and as far north as Avavik National Park, which is the extreme northwest corner of Canada's Yukon Territory, and so it borders directly onto Alaska and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so I was posted up there over the past few years, and having grown up in a very different environment in the city of Calgary, which would be very, very much like to Denver, for instance, in terms of geography, out on the plains, but very close to the Rocky Mountains, you know, definitely below tree line. But to me, the Arctic environment before I went up there on this assignment as a park ranger was very foreign. And I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I certainly had some ideas and some notions and some dreams of what I'd like to see and what I'd like to experience. But when I got up there, I set off on my first patrol of this national park, which is very remote. The nearest town is hundreds of miles away, so we would fly in with a small plane with tundra tires, land on the Arctic tundra, throw out two inflatable rafts, and we would raft down the interior river of this national park for 10 days. And that was how we would conduct our park patrols. Well, the very first patrol that I did in spring 2001, and spring in the Arctic is late June, we encountered this caribou herd of 123,000 animals that was crossing through the park, swimming across this river, on its way to their calving grounds, their preferred calving ground, on the coastal plain of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And this herd of 123,000 animals, I mean, it's not like watching elk in Yellowstone National Park pass in front of your vehicle, or, you know, a few deer in the Maine woods pass in front of your house or your tent camp. This went on for 2 full days and 2 full nights of animals coursing across this river, and not only the caribou, but all the animals and all the life that they tow along that Arctic landscape with them. So that this huge sort of tundra landscape of rolling hills and mountains, and this deep river canyon, had virtually been silent before the caribou started arriving, and all of a sudden it was just throbbing with life. At one point we saw 8 grizzly bears, you know, in various stages of being downstream, hoping for some caribou that didn't make it across to wash up. Others lying in the bushes waiting in ambush to scare caribou that were coming out of the water. We saw wolves, foxes, golden eagles dive bombing down, peregrine falcons. I mean, it was just amazing. And then after 2 days, and again, you know, this is all from the perspective of somebody who's never experienced anything like this before, except maybe, you know, through the written word in stories about what it used to be like on the plains where I grew up in Calgary with a bison. And this is really that level of life still up in the Arctic. And so after 2 days of being immersed in this and not being able to sleep because of all the dramas that were constantly unfolding around us, the last few hundred animals climbed up over the ridge and disappeared to the west. And after having been a part of that energy and part of that power, it was really hard to kind of be left in its wake, in its silent wake, and a huge part of me wanted to go with it, to follow those animals over that ridge, and to continue to observe and feel the events that would unfold as they continued to pass across the landscape, and also to satisfy curiosity, like, where the heck were these animals going, and why were they traveling with such motivation and such force across this landscape, so focused on getting somewhere? Where was that place, and why was it important? And so those are the questions that sort of swam around in my head as I continued on my patrol north down the river, and then we got picked up in the Arctic Ocean, flew back to the park headquarters office, which is in the nearest town of Inuvik in the Northwest Territories. And I got back, and, you know, part of this caribou herd was still inside me, rattling around, and it led me to books, to reports, to past television documentaries, to find out. I mean, I was just thirsty for knowledge, to find out more about this caribou herd. And And that's when I learned about where they were headed, was their preferred calving grounds on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, an area that by, you know, the best archaeological estimates that they've been going back to year after year for at least the last 27,000 years. And I learned about this proposal that's been swimming around in the background and debated in very hotly contested issues. Most Americans know, probably the largest environmental issue in all of the U.S. right now, of this proposal to drill for oil in the exact place where this caribou herd goes to have their calves every year. And so that really sort of interested me, concerned me, and I started thinking, wow, like, do people know? Do people understand that it's this amount of life, that it's this concentrated life that's heading to that place? And I wanted to really share that, those feelings, those initial powerful feelings I've had of the caribou, and let it be known, because I think one of the greatest tragedies in the world would be if we sacrifice something or compromise something or lose something without ever really understanding what's there that we've lost. And I think that would be a great tragedy in terms of this caribou herd and Arctic refuge. So I started thinking about how to bring this story alive for people. And I got talking to my wife, Leanne Allison, who's, you know, a very accomplished adventurer, mountaineer in her own right. And we'd both done a trip a couple years before, walking from Yellowstone up to the Yukon, to try to bring alive the story of wildlife that need to travel between parks and reserves and wildlife corridors. And we thought, could we do something like that with the caribou? Could we help to bring their story alive? And so over a period of months, this idea began to hatch of trying to be caribou, trying to travel like this caribou herd, travel with the caribou herd and experience everything they do, the wolf pack encounters, the half-frozen river crossings, the blizzards, the hordes of bugs that emerge in early summer, and experience everything that they go through to get to the calving grounds and back to their winter range again, and in that way try to sort of articulate the caribou's voice, try to articulate the value of the Arctic refuge that up till now we've always been talking about in barrels of oil, billions of barrels of oil, when in fact the caribou's voice has gone unheard. So we thought the value would be in everything they go through to get there and back again.
Well, now, there's some challenges here. First of all, I'm just trying to imagine how it is that you happen to find a mate who would tolerate such a vision. Did you ever discuss this when you got, when you got married? Listen, is it possible that you want to accompany me on some of the most extraordinarily difficult challenges that you'll ever face as a human being?
Well, isn't that the vow that everybody takes in marriage?
I don't think so. No.
Well, Leanne and I have quite a long history. In fact, we first met when we were 5 years old in kindergarten.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, we go back a fair ways, and we kind of fell out of contact with one another for about 13 years. Huh. And then it so happened in university I was working as a canoe instructor for one of her best friends. And after I'd been working for 2 weeks, her friend, who was my boss for that summer, called Leanne up and said, "You got to come down to this canoe club and meet this guy that's working for me. He's like the male version of you."
That's funny.
So we met, you know, over a decade later, and we kind of led these parallel lives in terms of interest. And a lot of those interests did revolve around traveling in the outdoors and adventuring. And so I think we really are kindred spirits. And so, you know, immediately when I started to think of this idea, Leanne's response wasn't thinking of all the reasons why we shouldn't do it. She was really excited about the reasons why we should. And we certainly, you know, over the many months and, in fact, a full year of preparations that it took to get ready for this trip, we certainly encountered a lot of sort of naysayers or people trying to dissuade us from even trying to do this. And quite frankly, there were tons of unknowns. I mean, most of the time when you set off on a trip, and certainly on our Yellowstone to Yukon expedition, this was the case, you make a route plan. You know, you decide, okay, I'm going to travel here, this valley, go along this ridge, and you sit down with, you know, hundreds of maps and you work it all out, the distances, the elevation gained and lost, where you would put food caches, how long it's going to take you, and you develop a schedule and goals and destinations. And this trip with the caribou really, you know, we sort of started heading down that road in our minds. It's like, wait a minute. We don't know where these caribou are going to go because, quite frankly, their migration routes change from one year to the next, both in timing and route. I mean, they could take one mountain range from the Yukon up to Alaska one year and completely switch to another one the next year. And they might even start up one and then kind of change their mind halfway through because of whether it's snow or weather or other things we don't even understand, and adopt an entirely different route. And so there's a huge amount of unpredictability and lack of things to hang the future on for us. And I think that became the biggest challenge as we started to prepare for this trip is all the unknowns, all the unpredictabilities that we were going to head out into. And so we couldn't put one food cache in before we left. We didn't know if we were heading for 4 months or 6 months or 7 months. And we had to put all our faith in these wild animals as our guides and really sort of surrender ourselves to all their whims.
That, to me, in reading your book, was one of the most amazingly difficult things to perceive, is how, as a couple or an individual, but this was a couple, you make the decision to head out on an uncharted course, and as well, not just an uncharted course, but an uncharted course through some extraordinarily difficult terrain. I know that you did a lot of research in terms of there have been radio collared studies of the caribou movements, and so you had a concept of where they go historically and how they might travel. But to head out into that terrain with everything on your back, you know, how did you prepare? I mean, let's talk a little bit about kind of even the technical side, the gear side of this. How did you imagine, what did you put in your pack? How did you make those decisions? Because those had to be extremely difficult decisions.
No, they were. I joke in the book, in the prologue, that sort of our collective Arctic experience amounted to a couple months. And most of those experiences were on a well-stocked raft, river raft, running down a river. So it's a completely different idea when you start thinking about traveling overland. And really all Leanne and I had to tap into were our mountaineering skills. And so we really did we considered a lot of different options, Sydney, but what we really decided in the end is because we have to be able to sort of pack up and go at a moment's notice when the caribou start to move, or if they stop, we have to be able to pitch this tent. You know, it has to be very quick to set up. It has to be portable. It has to be light. So that we don't get tired from carrying excessive weight, and we have to be able to pitch it on a rocky ridge or in a swamp or absolutely anywhere. We sort of melded sort of mountaineering technology with this unorthodox notion of following a wild herd of animals across the tundra, and so we dried all our own food, we packaged it up into balls, for lack of a better word of describing it, that were wrapped with tape and garbage bags and crushed newspaper for padding, and then had those all sitting in a warehouse at one town on the Canadian side and another town on the Alaskan side, where we could call in for them as we were going, as we were running out of food. We'd call in to have them delivered by bush plane and dropped out of the sky, essentially, to our location. We would communicate that over a satellite phone, but all of a sudden, okay, we're going to take a satellite phone, so now we have to have some way, means of charging it over these many months. And so that led to, a whole other arm of research into the latest solar panels and recharging technologies. And then once we had that kind of figured out, we thought, well, if we've got some battery power, maybe we can do some filming of this trip as well. And so that led to a whole thing where Leanne actually headed off on a week-long course in filmmaking. And you know, to her incredible credit, not only did this trip, but pulled off an award-winning film about the journey as well.
Well, there were lots of decisions. I mean, it's one thing to take off cross-country with a heavy pack. And by the way, what kind of weight were you each carrying?
It varied depending on how recently we received the food supply. So mm-hmm. right after a food supply, our packs weighed somewhere in the order of 60 to 70 pounds.
Those are very heavy packs.
Yeah, and at one point, I don't know if you remember the book, we're in the sort of heart of the post-calving rush. We're just doing all we can to keep up. And in order to avoid having to wait for a plane to come in, we actually carried a whole month of food. So that was 90 pounds once you added up the month of food and all our equipment.
But here's the thing that now, this is the thing. So you got these heavy packs, but you're also going through snow and over mountain passes, and that's as strenuous as it gets.
Yeah, and we really didn't have a good sense, I think, of what the snow conditions were going to be like before we left. And part of the reason the caribou migrate south after they calve is they're trying to get back below tree line, so latitudinal tree line, before the winter winds hit. Because what the winter winds do is they take the snow, and there's not tons of snow, but there's enough snow, and it just packs it to concrete-like consistency out on the open tundra. So the caribou can't dig down to get at their food, so they migrate down below tree line to spend the winter, where the trees, although they're kind of these stubby, small, short trees, not anything like we're used to down south here, but these trees still do provide enough shelter that the snow remains very soft, and so the caribou can crater down. Well, it makes for great feeding for the caribou in winter, but it makes for horrendous traveling. I mean, it's kind of like walking through this sugar-like consistency of snow that collapsed underneath you. So when we started out from the Porcupine River, which is kind of the northern extent of their winter range, it's still treed in that area, and we set off, presuming that we could just sort of ski in the wake of this caribou herd. And what we found was, even with these long, 8-foot-long skis, our weight was enough that we would just plunge through right to the ground. There was absolutely no support in the snowpack. And so we were wallowing, and within minutes of leaving that very first day, and already overwhelmed with the whole notion of sort of heading off into this great unknown on this uncharted route, and not knowing even how many months we were going to head off for, we sort of make the realization within the first few minutes that we're not even going to be able to travel for the first while in the way we'd assumed we would. We were carrying our skis and having to walk in the trenches that the caribou had left behind, very much like balancing along a narrow, slippery log for kilometer after kilometer. It's very exhausting.
That type of snow is impossible because it's there is no traction. I've been in that, and it's as difficult as it is. You just each foot just sinks.
Yeah, it's kind of like walking on frozen ball bearings. To some extent.
Yeah.
But it was a neat thing too, because immediately we just had to. The only way forward was to follow exactly in the caribou's footsteps. Mm-hmm. So it became very metaphorical. How much even we had to give up our notions of how we're going to do the trip right in the first few minutes. All of a sudden we're carrying these skis instead of using them. Now that all changed mm-hmm. as we did break out of tree line over the first few weeks, and we hit that concrete like
first few weeks. I like that.
No, yeah.
let's talk about that timing, because timing was a very critical thing. I mean, you were on foot. This wasn't the National Geographic expedition where you're kind of the helicopters drop you. They have search teams and they drop you within 500 yards of your of the herd. you guys had to leave from a point and then try to find the caribou, which all by itself was a challenge, and try to catch up to them and then follow them. And we're going to talk about that takeoff point, but let's talk how it is that you came to decide literally when to leave. I mean, that's a big decision. Timing is critical.
Yes, no, certainly, and that would set up whether or not the whole journey was successful. And so the big question for us was, are these caribou kind of milling around their winter range, or are they starting to migrate? And we didn't want to leave too early because if they weren't migrating yet, we would expend sort of our valuable energy and food and enthusiasm at kind of going in circles following these caribou and not sort of heading towards their calving grounds. So the timing was critical, but even from the biologist reports and the radio caller data and everything, that you just couldn't sort of discern from a distance on what was actually happening, whether the caribou were kind of starting to head north or not. And so what we decided to do is we flew in to a small village in the Yukon called Old Crow, and it's a Gwich'in village, Gwich'in being a sort of band of Athabasca native people who have lived up there for and their survival has been tied to the caribou for over 10,000 years now. And so these people, it's a small town, a handful of trucks that have been flown or barged in over the years. It sits out along the Porcupine River, and on every table of the 400 residents, you know, as we went into their small cabins, there'd be a bowl of dried caribou meat. Out back, there'd be caribou skins hanging from the hunts the fall before, and everybody, the talk on the street would be like, the rest of Canada during the hockey playoffs, but it wasn't about hockey, it was about caribou movement. And so these people are incredibly attuned to when the caribou might be through and which direction they might be going. But a lot of that talk, we soon realized, was very speculative. And people were, within an hour of us arriving and asking questions about where caribou might be and what they might be doing, we got a whole host of answers, everything from that we were already too late, they'd already been through and over the Porcupine River and well north, to people saying we're way too early and we should wait till May,
right,
which is in early April. So the and I immediately are sort of plunged into the state of confusion and back and forth. And then we happened upon this gentleman that figures very prominently as a character in the book at the beginning and the end, Randall Tetlici, a 50-something-year-old Gwich'in man, and he'd been out hunting the day before, and he had got a few caribou. And so we ended up at his doorstep and talked about what we'd like to set off and do. And, you know, he didn't have any immediate answers, and he didn't offer any opinions, unlike a lot of other people we'd run into. And he was very quiet, soft-spoken. But there was something about the look he gave us and the way he invited us in, and we had a lunch of caribou soup that really sort of told Leanne and I that this was somebody whose advice we should listen very closely to. You know, it was more of it's hard to articulate, it was more of a sense or a feeling than anything else. And so over the course of the afternoon, he agreed that the next day he would take us to this place where he'd been hunting, about 60 miles outside of town, and we would go by snowmobile the next morning. And so off we headed, and sure enough, later that day, we encountered groups of hundreds of caribou crossing the river in the same spot. And yet, as we pitched camp that night, it was in a small trapper's cabin along the river, and the river's frozen at this time, of course. We're all uncertain, and even Randall's uncertain, whether indeed the caribou are migrating or not. And that night it gets dark, and we end up around the table by candlelight, and there's a small fire going in the wood stove. And Randall starts to tell all these incredible stories about times when he'd been hunting and his boat had blown up and burned, and he'd had to do a combination of swimming and walking for weeks to get back to town, and stories about his grandfather, who had always known when to send out Randall and his brothers to go hunting, when the caribou would be coming through, and just the incredible power that he had. And Randall started giving us advice on the journey that lay ahead, and probably one of the most important pieces of advice he gave us was to listen to our dreams, to pay attention to our dreams. And that night, there's some old caribou skin hides lying around the cabin, and I made a nice bed for Leanne. And so she went to sleep, and I slept on the floor, and Randall slept on the bunk on the other side. And the next morning, we woke up and still uncertain, no caribou in sight now, still uncertain, should we head off and follow them, or should we still wait? And then Leanne recalled that she had a dream that night, and the dream had been of the Porcupine River, which was covered in, you know, a sheet of ice many feet thick and capped with snow. At this point, she had a dream that that river had broken up. It had started to melt and flow. And that dream, like, I was kind of skeptical, you know, here this native man had told us to pay attention to our dreams the night before, and now all of a sudden my wife was having this dream. And what did it all mean? And was it very believable? But Leanne's look assured me that it was true. Indeed, it was a very vivid dream. And I looked at Randall, and he had none of that sort of questioning or doubt in his eyes, and he just sort of quietly said, well, there's your answer. You guys got to get going. And so literally we packed up, and we found the most well-trodden trail that left the river, and we followed that up the first hill into our first forest and took our first footsteps, and that was how this incredible journey started.
And I'd like to take a break here, and when we return with Carsten Hoyer, we're going to take that first step with him. So hold on. We'll be right back here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's all this about being caribou? You're about to find out more as Carsten and Leanne have to decide if it's the right time to leave, if they should or even can make the commitment to take that first step into the unknown. The journey continues when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. We continue our story of adventure and spirit and mystery and dreams with Carsten Hoyer, who is the author of Being Caribou, which is published by Mountaineers Books. And he's taken us to the point where he's about ready to take literally that first committed step to this extraordinary unknown adventure. Carsten, welcome back.
Thanks, Ed.
This is when I was reading your book, and by the way, it's a terrific book. It literally takes the reader along with you. I feel like, I mean, really, it's like I know both you and Leanne as friends, having read the book. And the thing that occurred to me, I'm a dreamer and a bit of a romantic, and I like to take on challenges and this and that. And I do that, and then every once in a while, you hit a point where, okay, but now it's the moment where you have to literally, everything's in place now, and now you have to take that first step.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what was going through your mind literally at that moment.
Well, I think we were overwhelmed, to be perfectly honest. And I think the biggest thing that overwhelmed us at that point was just this lack of having any sort of a goal other than to follow wild animals. I mean, what helps us, I think, always to get through tough spots or to move forward as humans is to visualize where it is we're headed, to be fixated, if you will, on some sort of a goal. I mean, that's how we're brought up, and that's how we're kind of taught right from grade school on how to lead our lives. And I think, you know, it's a convenient way, and it's a very productive way to some extent. But I think it's also a way that starts to close down other possibilities. We travel through a lot of life, I think, with blinders on, just so focused on where it is we want to get. And when I say where, I mean, you know, whether it's in terms of some sort of physical situation that we want to be in, or some sort of financial situation, or some sort of emotional situation. And I think in direct contrast, what we had to learn to do on this trip, and this was sort of the most painful part of starting, was to let go of all of that, to let go of being able to visualize where it is you're headed, because we didn't know. And we really had to give up all our control over our future to these caribou that we couldn't even see at that time. You know, we'd glimpsed them the day before with Randall on the river, and now we were just following their trail and not really even knowing if we'd ever see them again, if this whole sort of far-fetched scheme of trying to beat caribou. And, you know, these caribou can move 20 to 50 miles a day, is what some of the scientific studies have shown. And here are these two humans with not much Arctic experience sort of trying to follow with them and hoping that once they do catch up to them, the caribou somehow will accept them, accept us, and we would sort of spend this euphoric time of traveling and maybe even becoming part of the herd. So those are all ideas and all those sort of doubts. And certainly, you know, those doubts have been articulated. They weren't only our own doubts. They've been doubts articulated by our parents, by other biologists, certainly by a lot of the Gwich'in people in Old Crow and other communities, and also, you know, some of the people that I'd worked with, some very well-seasoned travelers, the park wardens, park rangers in a national park where this whole idea had been hatched a little bit farther to the north. So I think that, more than anything, describes our state of mind was full of doubt, and really the only step we could do was to just sort of step forward, and much like traveling at night with headlights, is just sort of see where the next corner and where that next gap through the trees and where those next few hoofprints before us led.
Did you and Leanne have a means to communicate that moment when you decided it was time to commit? It's really a moment. You either, you know, you had the right to turn back and say, you know, maybe we really shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I think we had, by that point, we had put in so much effort and planning and preparation. You know, it would have been terrible to kind of give in at that point. I think we really, Leanne and I are both of the temperament and ilk. I think that once you decide to do a journey, and that moment of commitment had come many months earlier, if not a year earlier for us, and it really was time to sort of see if the actual journey could be what we had visualized or whether it would be something else. And we had to at least try. We had to at least set off and start to understand that. And you know, I guess some of my doubts I had expressed the night before with Randall and even the day before when we first met him in the village of Old Crow. And he kept saying, well, when you get to the calving grounds, and when you follow the caribou off the calving grounds, this and this might happen, or you might see this. And I kept correcting him, saying, no, Randall, if we get to the calving grounds, if we can follow the caribou. And he would just fix me with this steady stare and say, you have to believe. To do this, you have to believe you can do it. I believe you guys can do it. And just sort of, you know, some of his words were really ringing in my ears. And it was funny, like, living in southern society, I guess, and even in the city of Calgary, where a lot of our friends and family continue to live, a very urban environment, the doubts were greater in those kinds of places. But once we got farther and farther north, and closer to the people who actually knew this caribou herd and their movements and knew that environment, certainly there were still doubts, but those doubts seemed to be less the farther north and the closer we got to the actual start of the journey. So by the time we set off, I think the doubts were starting to almost fade a little bit. And just like, yeah, like maybe this is possible. And so off we went. I mean, we were still doubtful, we were still worried, but off we went. There comes a time, I think, at any in any trip, and maybe it's just a moment, where you just have to kind of throw yourself at the fate and the compassion of the world with the belief that it will accept, maybe even nurture, embrace you, you know, the world, that there is compassion just in the greater world to see you through a difficult time. And that might come in swimming a river, or it might come in a bear encounter. It's sort of in these moments of lack of control. And normally those moments take many days, if not weeks, or maybe months to get to on a normal scheduled journey where you have your route set out before you. I think with this journey, we had to confront that moment right at the start. We had to say, we are sort of going to step off and out into the great unknown and a great unknown idea and a great unknown landscape. But we believe that the world is this compassionate place that will sort of greet that courage and reward that bravery with incredible experience. And I think this was a trip which demanded that very early on, that kind of commitment. And it was difficult to do, but it also came with incredible rewards. And I think those are the rewards that excited me the most about telling this journey in the book, and something that we could get at a lot more in printed word than we could in the film is sort of the spiritual side of this trip, what happened as we let go of our human tendencies to be fixated on goals and objectives and became much more open to happenstance and unscheduled encounters and directions taking hold of us and steering us to different places, not only in the physical landscape, but the mental landscape as well.
One of the things that amazes me about your journey is, first of all, you had an idea of approximately how far it would be to the calving grounds. How far was that?
Well, a straight line distance, I guess, or arcing along one of the mountain ranges which the caribou might take on their migration would be somewhere in the order of 400 miles to the calving ground. And the caribou movements, once they do start the migration, once they select a route, it tends to be fairly direct migrating to the calving ground. After the calving happens, and the post-calving movements, because we needed, you know, to have a true measure of what the value of the calving ground are to this caribou herd, we felt we not only had to get there with the caribou herd, but the value of those calving grounds was also in everything they went through to get back to their winter range.
That is what actually, I think, it takes us to a whole other level. I think a lot of people can imagine following a caribou herd to their calving grounds and saying, wow, we did that. You committed to a return trip. That to me is, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible for me to say, having gone through what you did, 400 miles in this kind of condition, I think I would have said, that's enough. Okay, you know. But you had another whole other, and we'll talk about that, but you had also to commit to returning through the same, hitting this again. You guys went a long ways.
Yeah, it was about, in its entirety, I mean, you do tons of, especially after the calving, when their movements become much more random, kind of circling, feeding, and at the whim of insects and winds, there's a lot more meandering. And so it's impossible to know exactly what distance we traveled, but kind of roughing it out on maps, it was somewhere in the order of 1,000 miles the whole trip over the span of 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And really to kind of, I guess, articulate it very plainly for the listener, you know, this is truly one of the largest, wildest, intact ecosystems and landscapes, wild landscapes left in the entire world. I mean, we wandered through this area for 5 months. The range of the caribou herd is somewhere in the order of about 90,000 square miles. And in those 5 months, you know, we didn't cross one road, we didn't cross one pipeline. There aren't any power lines there, except for the villages of Old Crow and over on the Alaskan side, places like Venetee and Antarctic Village, which are all below tree line. There's no human habitation. There's, apart from the odd, research shack, there's no human structure. So we're really talking about a vast, vast, wild, open area, and one of the wildest areas left.
You left in April, and talk about the, I mean, a lot of people think, well, April, that's spring, but let's talk now about your taking off and how you tried to find and determine where these caribou were. I mean, that's, that all by itself is, I mean, you're walking and you're carrying all of this stuff, and then you're supposed to somehow figure out where they are and catch up to them. Let's discuss that journey until the moment where you actually, because there's many, many levels to this, and your book goes into this, and it's an extraordinary story. But let's try to get to the, let's move from this point now to where you finally made contact.
Okay. And just to, again, place the listener a little bit. So we left in early April, and this was in 2003. And early April, we're just north of Arctic Circle, so you're already getting a lot of light well past the normal evening and night hours that you'd be used to in more southern locales. So it was light from about 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. at this time. And those days are only going to lengthen as the trip goes on. Of course, start to decrease after the summer solstice. But the temperatures during those nights are still getting down to somewhere in the order of minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit. So frigid. And then if it was sunny during the day, they would climb, you know, very close to freezing. So you're going everything from traveling in a light jacket and a light wool hat to being burrowed underneath this down sleeping bag that is, you know, almost a foot thick with feathers at night, just curled up against one another for warmth. So that gives you an idea of the temperatures. And the landscape is quite rolling, so quite high hills that then start to break out into rocky ridges the farther north you go. And lightly treed, again, and soft snow where the trees are, so kind of wallowing along these caribou trenches. And where the animals were traveling, they would, you know, in the interest of saving energy, they would have been traveling single file. So these trenches you're following have literally been passed over by tens of thousands of hoofs, so they're very well packed. And so they're, you know, apart from their uneven surface, they're almost like these very, very narrow sidewalks. But we were tied to those. We couldn't move anywhere else out into the landscape. And then what started happening as we followed them over the first few days, the caribou, where they had fanned out to feed, all of a sudden those thousands of hoofs are splitting and forking until you're on, and you have to make a decision each time which one to follow. And so we're always following the most well-packed trail, but after some time, if the entire herd had fanned out to feed on the lichens poking through on the rocks or some of the lower tree branches on a hillside, all of a sudden you're in soft snow again because only one animal has gone anywhere. They're not walking single file anymore. They're just feeding. And you'd have to find the place where all those single trails collected and braided back together into a rope of a trail where you could follow it back out. So incredibly kind of confusing, and even these patterns we hadn't really thought about ahead of time. We just assumed, okay, once we're on a trail, we're on a trail. But a trail changes as time goes on. So we really struggled for that first little bit, and we noticed over the first few days the tracks that we're following are getting older. And so we haven't even found the caribou. We haven't seen caribou yet. And of course, in the back of our minds, is this even possible? And we're getting direct feedback that maybe it is, but we're already falling behind. We're not traveling as fast as the animals. We're falling. But then, you know, things are very dynamic, of course, and things started to change as we got a little bit higher on the ridgetops. The snow would be harder because it'd be windswept, and we could travel faster and even ski at times. So we started making up some time there. The trees started to thin out the farther north we went. And the weather during the day especially started to warm to the extent that some of the south-facing slopes actually started to lose some of their snow. The sun would carry enough heat during the day that it would uncover some of the grass and lichens and caribou forage underneath. And And this was incredibly well-timed on the Caribou's part. I mean, they would have known that this was happening. And all of a sudden, the investment of starting to head north from the soft snow into that a tundra landscape where it's concrete snow in the winter, it would pay off because the sun would be starting to melt that concrete like snow and they could continue to feed as they headed north. Well, what that did is it started to slow them down. And so by the end of the first week, Leanne and I were starting to encounter some small groups of caribou. And again, we weren't convinced of whether they were feeding or migrating still. And finally, I think it was on day five, as we climbed probably one of our first really, really tough ascents of one of the bigger mountains and kind of sitting exhausted on the top, sweating, all of a sudden groups of thousands of caribou start to thunder from behind us and come up this incredibly steep slope in our wake and move around us through that first night.
And what was your feeling at that time?
That was sort of euphoria. I mean, everything we had ever imagined this trip could be, and you know, this is a trip a year in the preparation, and all the sort of visuals we'd had in our mind of what it could ever be, and sounds, you know, the snorts and the click of tendons as they're passing around the tent, the smell of the urine and the tufts of hair blowing past us in the breeze, everything that we'd ever imagined. All of a sudden, it was happening right there around us on day five, and it was just, it was unbelievable. And not only that, but, you know, from that same ridge, we watched our first wolf chase of the caribou take place, and to watch that from this ridge and this horde of animals kind of move almost like a school of fish with this dot steering and moving and breaking them apart behind them, just to see those kind of patterns on that vast scale in this beautiful open landscape, we were just completely blown away. So all of a sudden, there was no doubts in our mind, and even though we'd been exhausted minutes before, all of a sudden we were just filled with this surge of energy. And I think that was very much the beginning of this sort of tension that goes on throughout the entire trip, where we're trying to keep that feeling. Like we've almost already become addicted to that feeling of being in amongst the caribou, of that power, of that energy, of that life, of things happening all the time, and that becomes our motivation for moving and for pushing ourselves further and further physically and mentally during the course of the many months that transpired.
That had to have been a massively spiritual moment, where suddenly the purpose of this becomes real.
I think, you know, it certainly was spiritual, but it was almost, I think the real sort of spiritual, it was too early for the real sort of spiritual things to start happening. Mm-hmm. We still were very much sort of modern technical humans,
gotcha,
carrying the baggage of all the ways we've been indoctrinated to think and perceive the world with us. And so, I mean, even, you know, it's evident in my journal entries that first night, like I'm really trying to describe the actual numbers of the caribou that we're seeing. And I'm not really going into a lot of detail about my own feelings or what the caribou are evoking in me. I'm just sort of describing the physical scene.
You're being the field biologist.
Yeah, you know, very, very analytical and descriptive and almost objective, you know, just sort of trying to describe it almost as an observer, mm-hmm, a distant observer, rather than as a participant.
I'm just curious, at that point you finally made contact, you were able to experience how fast these animals are traveling. Did that surprise, I mean, were you, as you watched them literally move, did you have wonders if you could actually maintain? How fast did they move, and did you feel you could keep up?
Yeah, I mean, up to this point, before we'd seen them, the question that had been brewing in our minds were, are they migrating yet or not? To see these thousands of animals rushing and literally turning like the snow, these snowy trails became black, I mean, sort of pounded down to the bare earth. And so you're seeing these threads of brown dirt across this speed by which they're moving, running, you know, at times, galloping, you're all of a sudden the question becomes, switches to, oh my gosh, certainly they're migrating, but can we keep up? And I think the thing that we were we wanted to just keep going, like to pack up right there and keep going, even though we've been going 11 hours that day and just completed this incredibly difficult climb to this ridgetop. And I think, you know, right there, like Leanne is sort of much more pragmatic and reasonable, I think, when it comes to thinking about the long haul. And she really was sort of this moderating force in our very small team on the expedition of I would constantly almost be obsessed with like taking off and literally trying to do everything the caribou were doing straight away, like, okay, they're moving through the night, let's move through the night. But Leanne was much more cautious in those beginning stages, and I think that very rightly so, you know, she was thinking a lot about pacing herself so that we could continue to travel for months on end.
That by itself becomes its own challenge.
Yeah, and very much tension, you know, like, so you're all constantly gambling, if we sleep now and the caribou are continuing to move, are we going to lose them forever? And that was a tension that played out through the whole trip, and as you remember from the book, I mean, there were significant periods of time where we had lost them and we're kind of kicking ourselves for earlier decisions we've made, and there are also points where there's a tension between Leanne and I, and she's saying, you know, let's stop, let's rest, let's hold ourselves back, and I'm pushing it at one point in the trip post-calving. You know, I really had to push hard, and it was important for us to just give up absolutely everything in terms of sleep, eating, and any semblance of being human and comfortable in order to keep up with the post-calving rush.
Very, very powerful moment in the book. How long did it take from that point then to reach the calving areas in Anwar?
Well, we first encountered the caribou at the end of the first week, and it was another 5 weeks before we would reach the calving ground. So in total of 1.5 months on the spring migration.
And that is a story that is filled with every conceivable level of challenge, joy, frustration, etc. Plus, ran into some really difficult moments, literally where your life was on the line. It came at many different times. I'm just curious if you could give us some examples of some of the moments where you really wondered how things were going to turn out.
Yeah, I think a few really stand out on the spring migration. And I think our first serious Arctic blizzard was the real testing time for both the and I. I mean, neither of us, even in our high altitude climbing, had never experienced anything like this, where the wind is literally bending the poles of the tent flat, and you're inside braced against it with crystals of snow driven through, you know, the microscopic pores of the fabric of the tent, so that it's snowing inside this tent as well as outside. And just howling, and the whole tent is kind of collapsing and then popping up again and collapsing again. It's like you're inside this Gore-Tex hyperventilating lung, and we're terrified. You know, there's no shelter anywhere. This is our life around us of fabric and stitches. And we're inspecting every seam with every gust and every stitch, just praying that. You know, that they're not going to rip and fray, and it very much felt like it was going to, and almost panicked, I think, in that first Arctic storm.
And how long were you in that state?
Probably for about close to 24 hours that first time.
Temperatures?
Temperatures weren't terrible. I think the air temperature would have been somewhere around minus 10.
Yeah, that's cold, though. When you're human, 10 below zero with wind is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, the wind would have been somewhere in the order of, you know, between 100 and 150 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
It was just unbelievable. You couldn't stand. And then, you know, finally, in this first blizzard, what I did was, or what I decided, just like, this tent is going to rip to shreds around us by this wind. And so I went outside. one aluminum snow shovel between us and create this sort of V-shaped windbreak built out of this rock-like snow upwind of us. And as I was doing that, I looked up at one point and through the sort of horizontal haze of driving snow and cloud, I see these shapes and they're moving. And some are lying down, and some are even like grazing on these tufts of grass that are being pushed flat against the snow by the wind. And I just couldn't believe my eyes, and I dove back into the tent, and suddenly, and there's caribou outside.
Mm.
And she was just, you know, she didn't believe me, and she looked up like, sure enough, these caribou, you know, in that moment sort of became our guides towards how, that this was sort of, this was an everyday occurrence, almost like it wasn't abnormal, and the caribou would survive, and we would survive, and somehow, you know, the storm didn't become any less intense in that moment, but somehow our worry really subsided, and guided by these caribou, or supported almost by these caribou that had surrounded us, that we were going through this together, and we would all survive. And then probably the next thing that really challenged us the most was when the grizzly bears started to come out of their dens, started to come out of hibernation in early May. And the landscape is still quite snowy at this point and still very frozen. And we're skiing across it and you can see, you know, for tens of miles at times from the ridge tops, no trees hiding anything, and you would see four or five grizzly bears at a time wandering across this landscape, these dark sort of silhouette cut-out shapes across the white vastness. And as it turned out, all of them were doing exactly what we were doing, following this caribou herd, except they were doing it, you know, not to get to the calving grounds per se, but in the hopes of some lucking into some post-hibernation meal. And Leanne joked to me, you know, it's not long before one of these bears is going to realize we're the slowest caribou going. I kind of laughed too. I mean, we were concerned, but figured that we would be foreign enough that none of these bears would really want to mess with us. But that very afternoon, one was incredibly curious and approached where we were setting up camp. And then we managed to finally sort of shoo it off with shouts and waving our ski poles. But that night after moving camp, because of that initial curious bear, you know, I think probably one of the moments in the entire trip where we really did consider giving it all up and what we were doing was ridiculous was when this particularly old, hungry, and quite small, but very thin and sickly-looking female, a desperate bear, essentially, on the edge of starvation, came in, circled us, and began, essentially, it stalked us for 1.5 miles and wouldn't leave us alone where we were setting up camp for the second time. And that story and that encounter and how we finally resolved it, I think really is sort of one of the emotional, high point is the wrong way to describe it, but
yeah,
the most emotionally charged point, you know, both in the trip and in the book, and lots of questions that bantered back and forth between Leanne and I on really how reasonable it is for us to continue, given that we in fact have been treated as prey by one of these many animals now that are roaming along the caribou trail with us.
Yeah, you don't want this to become the story of survival with a bear tracking you and waiting for its most, you know, that we've heard those stories before.
Yeah, but again, I guess ultimately, you know, what we decided in all our options of aborting the trip or not, well, in a way, I don't think we really did decide consciously. Because it's such a vast landscape, it's so remote, and it's so difficult to land a plane in, even a bush plane at that time of year on skis, we would have had to travel for at least 2 days to even get to a place along the coast of the Arctic Ocean where a plane could have landed. And more likely than not, we would have waited a number of days more for good weather until that plane could land. And so we didn't have any immediate escape. You know, we couldn't head back to the ski lodge or hop in the car and drive home. regardless of whether we just had to continue the trip or not, we would still have to survive those next 4 or 5 days with in amongst the grizzly bears. And so we decided, well, let's just keep going today and see what happens. And I think, just the act of moving and the rhythm of moving itself, and certainly, anybody who's done a long trip has felt this. I mean, it's sort of like all your worries and concerns, they don't disappear, but I think the act of moving, because that's what we've evolved to do, and that's what we've done for, the greater part of 1.5 million years of human evolution. I think it really kind of puts all the stresses and concerns into their rightful place. And for us, that did happen. So after a while, I think we came to terms with, the notion that to truly be caribou, to experience what they did, experience on the incredible journey that they do every year, we had to come to terms with the possibility of dying. And certainly I think we talked about that before leaving on the trip, but now we're really confronted with it in sort of a living, furry, well-clawed, toothed animal that had really come in and challenged our sense of mortality. And I think at that point in the trip, we did really accept that we could die on this journey. And that was a really important step to take to get to, I think, the sort of mental state of being caribou.
One of the aspects as well, then, is the fact that you would have to have your resupplies airdropped in, and you had a choice at that point. You could say enough, At certain points, you were running out of food. You're running low on food, and you'd have to make decisions to bring in the food. Give us a sense of how that would happen.
Well, normally, when we had, say, 2 or 3 days of food left in our packs, we would start to say, okay, given our current trajectory and everything, where would be a reasonable place to receive a food drop? And if it's going to be dropped from the air, you want us to find an open place and hopefully with some soft snow, not too many rocks, so that the things that are being thrown on the plane, and, the plane would be traveling at an airspeed of somewhere around 60 miles an hour. So, and dropping from a few hundred feet up, you're really quite worried about all these bags of rice and stuff breaking open on the tundra.
Yeah.
And so that's one consideration. Another thing, we were recording this journey as well, through still photographs and through film. And so at any opportunity, we wanted to send that film out so that it wouldn't be lost or damaged. And also, it would just add up to a fair bit of weight over time. And so any opportunity to actually land a plane, whether it was on a frozen lake in winter or an open lake in summer, we would try to capitalize on those opportunities. So, we were trying to stay with caribou, and yet we found ourselves every couple of weeks kind of pulled back to our dependencies as modern humans in having support from the outside world. And it was an interesting dynamic that started to happen as the journey unfolded, is that we would have these incredible moments and even prolonged moments in terms of weeks of traveling and being in amongst the herd. And then we would decide, okay, we need food. We're going to try to receive it at this lake. And almost every single time, we would make that decision, commit to it, make the phone call to the pilot, give him our location, and then the weather would close in, and we would spend 3, 4, at one point even 6 days waiting. And meanwhile, the caribou have moved on. We're losing them. And so it was this tension between sort of our dependence on the outside world undermining our ability to really be a part of this caribou migration, and then sort of trying to, once we did receive the food drop, at one point anyway, near the end of the trip, pretty much starving and having to trap ground squirrels and things to survive as we're waiting for it, then trying to sort of regain our place in amongst the migration, and that sort of became this back and forth dynamic that played out during the entire journey.
I'm just curious, from a sort of a technical perspective here, if you had to relay your location, would you rely on GPS and map, I suppose, is how you were kind of tracking through your journey?
Yes. Yeah, it was a combination of things. Yeah, so we carried a small GPS receiver. And, at times that actually came in handy. Like, I've never used one or had felt the need to use one before, but when you get into some of the open tundra landscapes where the features are very uniform and indistinct, and then you layer coastal fog or blizzard conditions on top of that, to travel and navigate through that to some of these set locations for receiving food drops or to try to return to your last point where you've been amongst caribou, those tools definitely help. And that, sort of a side note on the modern tools, this trip probably wouldn't have been possible to do in the style that we did it, say, 5 years ago even. Satellite phones were these big, heavy briefcase objects until just a few years ago. Now they're the size of a portable cordless phone that you have in your house. And even the recharging technology, to a small, flexible, very robust solar panel, nickel metal hydride batteries instead of nickel cadmium, are much lighter. Just all these little details of technology that really enabled us to do this trip, just two people, no film crew, carrying everything that we would need to not only do the trip but film it on our backs. I don't think that opportunity or technical opportunity existed until a very short time ago. And yet, in terms of following caribou, allowing ourselves to be steered by their movements and migrations is a very old human activity. I mean, that is one of the really neat things about the trip is when we did return to Old Crow, the Gwich'in native village, at the end of the trip, the way we talked and the stories we told had elders weeping because of how much it reminded them of the very language and sort of visual images that their parents and grandparents' stories had evoked of when they had followed the caribou, not necessarily to get to their calving ground, but simply to eat and survive.
You became indigenous. At
indigenous,
what point?
But still, this is kind of the ironic thing, still heavily dependent on a modern technology to do that.
Good point. It sounds as if somewhere in this realm you were becoming caribou. That is to say that your spirit and your purpose and your will became truly locked in with that migrating herd. Was there a moment where you began to sense the first sense of being caribou?
A couple of things, I guess, to answer that question. And to me, incidentally, I just let the listener know that I'm trained as a scientist to see the world rationally, discrete parcels, and sort of have an analytically trained mind. But the transformation that I felt happened during this journey, I think, and the spiritual transformation is probably one of the most exciting parts of the trip. And I guess, on any long journey, what happens is that the layers of your old self and sort of your, almost your fabricated self start to fall away like layers of an onion. And this started to happen to Leanne and I, and we all know kind of sometimes you're hiking along or skiing along, and this old song might pop into your mind, for instance, and the lyrics just won't leave, like they rattle around in your head, sometimes it takes days. And this started to happen to Leanne and I after a couple of weeks, after we sort of started to settle into the rhythm of following caribou and give way to this whole notion of surrendering to all their movements and let the caribou guide us rather than our preconceptions guide us of having destinations and goals. But as our mind sort of started to relax and open up to that, these old song lyrics, these old phone numbers, all this sort of mental clutter, like these useless facts and figures that we all, and jingles that we carry around in our heads, all those began to fall away. And in the lack, in the absence of billboards and advertisements and radios blaring and, checking email and all the things that we kind of are distracted by in modern society, in the absence of those sort of filling that void or filling that space that was created as we were shedding all these other memories, I think we really began to unearth and uncover sort of our elemental self. And a lot of that elemental self, I think, is in the acuity of the senses. So we felt our senses becoming much sharper in terms of vision, smell, hearing. And as the trip went on, also just sort of almost like a sixth sense of knowing. And the sixth sense, I think, is I describe it as something as thrumming in the book. And thrumming is the sound that the caribou would make when they were together in large groups. But it isn't really a sound. It's more like a rumbling or a vibration. I think in the reading I've done since on whale song and other modes of animal communication, a lot of it is sort of infrasonic on the lower end or beyond the lower end of human hearing. And yet as Leanne and I sort of became sort of much more pure and much less distracted and much more focused, this sound that I had initially heard a little bit or felt sort of rumbling in the chest. And it's not, I'm not talking about the drumming of hooves on the tundra here. I'm talking about something else, almost like a humming, an energetic hum that comes up through your feet. I'd felt it a few times on the spring migration, but it wasn't until after the calving ground that we started to follow the caribou in their post-calving wanderings that we really started to tap into it, not just as, and it started to supersede, actually, and replace conventional methods of tracking the caribou, where, you know, we wouldn't look so much at ground signs in terms of hoof prints and fecal pellets that had been left behind on where we would find caribou next, but this sound, we would wake up from a nap, and this humming, we would sort of cock our heads and look at each other and, you know, try to articulate, yeah, it's coming from somewhere over there, and we would point sort of obliquely to some ridge, and we would pack up and let's just start heading in that direction, and a few hours later, we'd top over that ridge, and sure enough, there's a large group of caribou that had been around us when we'd fallen asleep, and that's where they'd moved to. So this, you know, we uncovered in our attempt to become caribou, I think, or in our attempt to, you know, to be caribou, we uncovered, I think, through the elemental sense of what it is to be human. Like we were able to tap into some of our biological potential, our wild potential, our instinctual potential that has become inundated, covered, and forgotten, I think, in the modern world. And that really became exciting to me, you know, to be steered by senses and knowledge in a realm and dimension that I'd never accessed before. And as we went along in the trip, and we became more sleep deprived and more hungry and starved and thirsty and muddled up by what was day and night as we're trying to follow caribou through you know, all periods of daytime and nighttime. We started to have, and you're literally feeling almost kind of dizzy at times, from the state of exhaustion. And it was all, I guess I kind of likened it almost to like a shaman sort of trying to will themselves or work themselves through dance and fasting and song into a whole other realm of consciousness. Well, we didn't consciously try to do that, but the caribou had kind of sent us on that journey that became that dance. And much like a shaman sort of transcends into different level of consciousness and accesses a dream world, which can inform them of events in the future, that started to happen to us as well, where our dreams really started to articulate scenes and dramas that would unfold hours later. And so the thrumming, our dreams, and these visions started to become the mode by which we would make decisions and inform our movement as we became closer and closer to tapping to the very energy that sends this great herd coursing across the tundra for thousands of miles every year.
Being Caribou with Carsten Hoyer continues after a short break.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
So what does being caribou mean? We find out as Karsten and Leanne continue onward. It's calving season in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where the porcupine herd of caribou have journeyed for over 27,000 years. Will their plans and the enduring struggle bring them to the site in time? Could it be that this wild adventure may actually succeed? We find out as your Voice of the Earth continues with this special edition of the Wildside News. So our conversation continues with Karsten Hoyer, the author of Being Caribou and his adventure with his wife Leanne, as they were becoming literally one, a human and connection with a caribou, to tell us the story of the larger story of what it really is to be caribou. And so I'd like to continue. Karsten, welcome back.
Thanks, Sydney.
Well, I think as listeners can tell, there's a lot to this book. And amazingly enough, the book is a fabulous fabulous read. And we're not even to the calving grounds in Anwar. Let's move ahead now and discuss what began to happen, because you basically it was one step after another. The journey continued day after day, week after week, and ultimately you became one with this migrating herd. And let's talk now about heading into the calving grounds in Anwar and what that meant to you.
Well, the 6 weeks into the journey, we arrived into the calving grounds. And, up to that point, we'd been going through tundra hills, through the Yukon Mountains, the Richardson Range, the Barron Range, the British Mountains of the Yukon, and starting to parallel the Arctic Ocean, so the Arctic Ocean would be 20 miles off to our right side as we're heading west, so off to the north. And really at that time of year, continuing to be completely frozen, so there's a white lens of ice kind of reaching off. And then finally, after 6 weeks, we kind of dropped out of all those chains of mountains and came out onto this 20-mile-wide patch of tundra. Still very much snow covered, the calving grounds hemmed in on the south side by the highest mountains we'd seen yet, 8,000, 9,000 foot peaks in the Brooks Range of Alaska, and on the north hemmed by the coastal ice of the Arctic Ocean. And so it's a very narrow area, and it's a very special area from the standpoint of the caribou. And over the course of the next 10 days, we would sort of experience all the reasons why they go to that particular place. But the first thing, I think, before we even could do that, we had to come to terms with how their behavior had shifted to such an extreme. During the course of the spring migration, they were relatively accepting of our presence so long as we were 100 or 200 or 300 yards away. We could pass them, and certainly when we were in the tent especially, they would pass us sometimes within a dozen yards. But all that really changed quite significantly when we arrived on the calving ground, and these animals that had been very accepting of us as travel companions all of a sudden became very skittish and sensitive, to the extent that we couldn't even step out of the tent and stand up if the caribou was 500 yards away without it fleeing. And I think, we can all kind of relate and understand this if we've had kids or if we've had friends or family who have had kids, in how, a pregnant human mother gets as she nears the time of birth, incredibly sensitive, just wants to have quiet, wants to be focused, doesn't want to be disturbed, and wants to have opportunities to sort of go into themselves to have to go get through this difficult process of birthing. And Leanne and I were soon realized that, heck, after weeks of traveling, now we can't literally move a step. We have to stay inside this tent. Because that tent acted like a blind. So long as we stayed inside, the tent, the caribou weren't disturbed. And so, you know, this tent, and it's tiny, by the way. It's this mountaineering tent, and it's 4 feet wide by 6 feet long, and about 3.5 feet high at its highest point. And so Leanne and I are kind of wedged in there against one another, and now all of a sudden we've become hostages in this tent. So up to then it basically been our bedroom, but now it's become our living room, our camera room, and I hate to say it, but our bathroom as well. We couldn't even step outside to relieve ourselves.
Well, there's a moment in the book which is one of my favorites, and also I think in terms of making a point of the significance of keeping these areas free from development of any sort, where you guys are stuck in the tent and nature calls, and there's a real problem.
Yeah, you know, we're kind of perplexed, if you will, how oil companies can talk about going to this very place and literally, you know, the caribou had led us to the very heart of their calving ground, their preferred calving ground. And it's also the heart of this known oil reserve that exists underneath. And so it's a direct conflict, a direct confrontation between these two types of use. And Leanne and I really kind of were left scratching our heads, thinking, you know, how can the oil companies say, as they have said, you know, you could come in and extract this oil without having an effect on this caribou herd, when two small campers who have literally skied and walked there can't get out of their tent to go to the bathroom without, you know, sort of setting off these stampedes that we feared would lead to abortions or abandonment of newborn in that, you know, for the first few hours, relatively helpless calves. And so we were really, you know, we were experiencing all that firsthand, and I really tried to sort of set off on this trip with an open mind and to be open to all possibilities and all scenarios of development or not. But, you know, and a lot of people say, well, could it work? Could it coexist? And I think, you know, we didn't have to do any science. I mean, all the science is out there that points of all possible places this is the worst you could ever develop in their entire huge range. But we experienced that elementally and anecdotally in a more convincing manner than any scientific report could do. In the fact that we became hostages in our own tent.
Describe the setting of this area, because it's very different than the areas that you had been traversing.
Yeah, so this coastal plain, it's almost like a prairie-like landscape where these rivers that had been that are very confined and take these twisting, roiling courses through canyons of the mountains spill out and spread in these sort of vast gravel plains. And one of the big reasons the caribou gather there, well, there's three actually. That the first one is that the wolves, and there are many wolf chases that I describe in the book, and a few that appear in the film as well, the wolves that had sort of tracked the migration and harassed the caribou for the first few weeks, they also are having their young, and so they've had to stop during the migration and find den sites to raise their young. So the caribou, and this is part of the big sort of adaptation of migration for a lot of hoofed animals, is to leave their predators behind.
Wow, that's interesting.
And to go to these predator refuges. So all of a sudden you have no wolves, and for reasons that biologists still don't understand, very, very low density of grizzly bears. So, you know, although Leanne and I had seen up to 4 or 5 grizzly bears in the same day, working our way through the foothills of the mountains. Once we were on the coastal plain for 10 days, we only saw one grizzly bear. And finally, now we're starting to get into early June, and as we were working our way through the last week in the mountains, we're sort of snow patch, hopscotching along these drifts and drifted in creek beds and ice shelves of creeks and so on to keep our skis on, with long bouts of walking across snow-free ground between. And in the mountains, it was harder. It's actually a little bit warmer because it's not as close to the ice of the Arctic Ocean. But this coastal plain, it's a little bit cooler. And that might sound like a disadvantage for newborn cows, but in fact, it's an advantage because with warmth in the Arctic and the arrival of spring and summer come bugs. And bugs in numbers and intensity that no one can really relate to unless it has experienced it firsthand. It's nothing like the worst. It's just an order of magnitude greater than the worst possible day you could imagine in the worst bug-infested place in southern Canada or the state. And it's not just mosquitoes I'm talking about. It's warble flies, which are a type of sort of house-sized fly that burrow underneath the hide of the caribou and lay their eggs. Very painful for the caribou. And then bot flies, which again, sort of wasp-like looking fly that goes up the caribou noses and burrows literally into their heads, and then the larvae can affect their brains. And these caribou will do anything, as we experience later in the trip, to avoid being harassed by these insects. And what the calving grounds provide, in being cooler from the Arctic Ocean, is a delay in the onset of those insects, so that while the insects are already starting to come out in the foothills and the warmer mountains, the next Arctic Ocean is delayed. And so for the first 2 weeks of life, these calves are spared the harassment of these insects.
It's extraordinary the way it all fits together.
It's just beautiful, like to see all the cogs and the machinery of nature interlocking and revolving firsthand, right from the timing of when the caribou left their winter range, when the sun was warming the snow and burning off the snow so they could access their forage in the windswept mountains, right to all the things that line up that make these calving grounds worth all the effort and energy to migrate to. To experience that firsthand was just amazing.
So you literally were camping amongst the birthing caribou. What was that like to witness that?
The Gwich'in people, one of the things that kind of came up before we left was the fact that nobody really should go to the calving grounds. It's taboo in Gwich'in culture to visit the calving grounds because it's that sacred of a place. Their word for the calving grounds in English translates to the sacred place where life begins. And Leanne and I we rationalized and justified it all to ourselves in that we were going to try to bring this story to a large amount of people and really to give a voice to this caribou herd. It was necessary for us to go to this place where really people shouldn't even be visiting. But I think, as soon as we were there and as soon as we were kind of surrounded and as soon as we are watching calves literally being born meters from the tent and those first few moments where the cow turns around and the umbilical cord is still hanging out of her hind end and she's licking this calf clear of the mucus and immediately nudging it to its feet, and the calf is sort of struggling onto wobbling legs and trying to support itself, almost like sort of splaying out these huge legs which are completely disproportionate to its tiny body and head, and trying to nurse from its mother and taking the first few steps in just a few minutes and walking within the first hour and running within the first day and just seeing this calf sort of explore life and its surroundings for the first time, but also explore the whole notion of being tied and bonded to its mother as it starts to on develop, it was really all sacred, just experiencing it. And initially for Leanne and I, it was very hard to be cramped up and cooped up in this tiny tent after moving, you know, for almost 50 days every day. It was almost like it'd be, to switch rhythms so dramatically was so difficult for us. But as soon as that started to happen around us, all that sort of restlessness inside of our bodies just vanished. And we became immersed in this incredible, almost trance-like state of watching all this transpiring around us, of cows giving birth. Not only that, but all the birds starting to arrive. Over 150 different species of birds come to this very place to nest and breed and give birth to their young. And so we would watch all the different kinds of birds, Lapland longspurs, white-crowned sparrows, and the Canada geese, the snow geese, the long-tailed jaegers, the king eider ducks, the long-tailed ducks, and watch them all arrive from seven different continents and start to go through all their courtship rituals and gathering materials for their nest and then giving birth to their young. It was just, all of a sudden, we'd been so preoccupied with travel, and all of a sudden, we were plunked down in one place and just overwhelmed with all the details that you'll only pick up, I think, if you are sitting in one place. And we were sort of forced to do that initially, but it didn't feel forced after just the first few days. There was so much going on, and life was so rich in all that was happening around us. We didn't need to move anywhere. Everything had sort of moved and surrounded us.
So how long did you stay in that area, the calving area? How long did they stay? Because, after all, you were following them.
Exactly. So, again, that was all dictated by them. And it was, you know, in the timeline of the whole trip, being 5 months, it was a very short time. It was only 10 days. It was a time just packed. It was 10 days packed with events unfolding. And then almost like a switch had been thrown after 10 days, and these calves had all been born now, and most of them were moving very well now. You know, and I mean, the precociousness of these calves is just unbelievable to witness firsthand. And in fact, biologists have tracked newborn calves 2 weeks old traveling 60 miles in a day. So they're built and have evolved to travel for sure, and this incredible 10-day period of all the cows staying in the same place, all the calves being born, and this bond forming without the stress of having to move, switched within the span of one 24-hour period, and all of a sudden all the caribou were gone. And what it is that sort of triggers this incredible shift yet again is that sort of the knowledge or the signs and signals, again, that Leanne and I weren't quite tapped into, but the caribou certainly were, that the bugs are going to emerge pretty soon. And when the bugs do emerge, you do not want to be out on the coastal plain, you know, a fairly wet, marshy area, where once that water that was all ice when we first arrived, it can't percolate through the ground because it's all permafrost underneath. And so it's all the standing water, perfect breeding ground for a lot of insects. And so the caribou headed back into the mountains, and it's a rush into the mountains. And what they're doing now is they're switching to a whole different strategy, which is to position themselves in basins where there will be fairly good forage, in the form of grasses and willows and other herbs, but within very close striking distance of high ridges, where when the wind dies, because the wind really, now it's going to, the wind is what's going to drive everything for their movement when the bugs are out. When the wind dies and the bugs start to swarm, they can go up in elevation and try to farm the wind in the heights of the ridge tops. When it becomes stagnant down below.
That becomes an extraordinary story. And in my own mind, I'm imagining being a newly born caribou and trying to figure out what this is all about, being part of this massive herd, and then learning what happens at birth, and this becomes the play of life that they're going to have to go through each season. It's a learning process for them. And you create this image of life for the caribou then following the birthing, where it is truly following the winds. And that helps to define, quite honestly, their movements from that point, that it's an unpredictable thing. And discuss that a bit. That's so fascinating.
Well, up to that point, I guess Leanne and I, we had to do this at one point in the spring migration. We always knew that, you know what, if we lose the caribou, we can always sort of take the default average migratory route and hopefully hook up with them in the calving ground. And we had to do that over the course of a two-week period when we did lose them for an extended time during the spring migration. Fortunately, we hooked up with them again long before we reached the calving ground. But this sort of new stress pressure presented itself after calving because their movements become so varied and unpredictable between years. And there isn't sort of this focused place that they're going to get to for the next few months, that if we lost them, chances are we would lose them for good. And so now we're sort of presented with this incredible pressure and desire to stay as closely with them as possible. And this really was the period when we pushed ourselves to extents that, you know, I never thought were humanly possible in terms of no sleep, very little food, and just piling on the miles for 22 hours out of 24. And this was a time when shamanistic ritual of working yourself into a different dimension of consciousness really started to take hold. And at times, again, you know, we would wake up from an hour-long nap, and the caribou that had surrounded us would be gone and vanished. And it was so difficult to sort of, there was no snow anymore to track them, no snow trenches. And even in places, depending on the ground, it became difficult to track, even though it was thousands and thousands of animals, they had left very little sign if the ground was particularly hard. And this became the time when we accessed this other way of knowing, and that was informed through the thrumming, through our visions, and through our dreams. And it kind of came, I think, at a point where we had been chasing the herd, and we were hoping to catch them after having lost them for 3 or 4 days, and we were really expecting to come across them in this one big basin, and what we got there was just totally confusing. Mixed messages of trails heading off in all directions, so we had no idea which one to follow, where to head, and I kind of found myself sitting in that basin, kind of laughing because what we were seeing was sort of the calligraphy of the past few days of wind, shift in direction of wind, and sort of the fruitlessness of everything we were attempting to do really kind of hit home in that moment, where we were trying to track the shifting nature of these shifting bugs and these shifting wind of days before. And I think that night, Leanne and I just kind of almost sort of, we physically and mentally collapsed. We just said, this is impossible. We can't do it. And it was almost like we stopped taking ourselves so seriously. And from that point on in the trip, we seemed to sort of tap into it was like that last bit of us that needed to open, that last bit of us that take ourselves so seriously had opened up. And once we left that behind, this drumming and the visions and dreams really kind of stepped in as the major method by which we navigated from then on during the trip.
Wow. Was this the point where you began to really sense being caribou? I mean, I'm sure it happened many times, but how does this moment relate to your whole sense of being caribou?
Well, what being caribou means, I think, is what a lot of us in modern society are sort of, you know, going to, whether it's Buddhist temples or yoga ashrams or through meditation. It's you know, a lot of us are trying to sort of, we're in this perpetual struggle to regain balance in what seems to be very unbalanced lives. And you know, it's almost sort of become cliche where people, a lot of these teachings, I guess, are encouraging us to live in the moment. And really, being caribou, when it comes right down to it, is all about living in the moment. It's all about acceptance. And it's all about surrendering to the flow of things rather than forcing things to happen. And rather than being fixated on outcomes, just being open to absolutely taking any direction and any pace that outside forces, you know, whether it's wind, snow conditions, wolves, presence of grizzly bears, are pointing towards taking. And not sort of trying to go against the grain and not trying to force things. And for Leanne and I, that really took a long time for us and months. And it was everything that happened along the way that really kind of, it's almost like it wasn't a conscious decision. It was a decision, or it happened because we kind of had all our teachings of how to live beaten out of us. It had been beaten out of us by the, you know, the sheer number of miles that we'd had to travel, the number of mountain ranges we'd had to cross, the number of rivers we had to wade and swim, the number of bears that we had encountered and sort of had to come to terms with threatening us, and the number of blizzards we'd had to endure, and then the swarms of bugs as well. And what it has all taught us, I think, over the many months, and what was so difficult to accept, and I think this is something that we have such difficulty in accepting in modern society, and it's what I think a lot of political manipulation takes advantage of, is that in truth there is no such thing as security. And you know, the caribou live with that knowledge, and they live in ways that accept that. And it took us a long, long time to accept that. And I think in accepting it, you know, accepting that death could be around the next corner, and accepting that inconvenience was part of living, in accepting that, you know, sacrifice of our own personal desires sometimes was necessary for greater spiritual and mental rewards. Those were all steps that we took along the way towards the path of being caribou. And what they allowed us to access was this incredibly instinctual, elemental, very natural dimension of knowing informed through our dreams. Like, after a while, we had no worries about where we were going to go, what we were going to do, whether we would be safe or not. We just were. We were just being. And it was almost like the caribou did recognize that as well. And there's one particular scene, I think, that for me is the sort of crescendo of the trip of being caribou. I'm talking about the mental and spiritual journey now, where for the first time all trip, you know, we're not just following caribou, but caribou are following us. And Leanne and I are walking, and the caribou literally, there's the whole group of bulls that are passing me within such close proximity that if I reach out my arms as I'm walking, I could touch them. And, you know, and all the old signs of them kind of being a little bit nervous or snorting, all those things have passed, and they're passing me like I'm one of them. And it was almost as if they recognized my very gait, my very movements, and the way I moved my limbs, that I had sort of transcended that modern conventional way of being human and had gone back to a more traditional way of being, which was probably part human, part caribou, and part something else.
It was at that moment in the book that there was an eye contact and a communication between you and particularly some males, where I suddenly felt as if that moment had arrived maximally for me personally. And in my journey with you, it was a powerful moment, like bravo. Well, all good journeys come to an end, and this one did too. Give us a sense of how it was that you finally decided to end the journey.
Well, in a way, despite all my talk about being caribou and leaving the modern conventional sense of being human behind, it was kind of the physical limitations of being human that finally forced us to end the journey. And it was quite ironic because this is into early August now, which is late summer, fall, by Arctic standards, and the shift of season is quite dramatic in the Arctic. So all of a sudden we're starting to get snowstorms, the weather's cooling down. Leanne and I found ourselves unable to recover from very simple things like, being soaked through by sleet. We just couldn't rewarm ourselves very easily anymore. It became very apparent that we had exhausted absolutely every last ounce of reserve we had left, and we had no margin of error anymore. Like if anything would have happened, if we would have messed up on a river crossing, or if another bear would have come in and challenged us, I don't think we would have had the energy reserves to respond in a proper way. So we, as difficult as it was, because of the flow we'd become a part of with the caribou, we had to make the decision to start heading back ourselves, to start heading south, to start the fall migration without the caribou, essentially. And so we started heading to Old Crow, and a really wonderful thing happened then. By this point in the annual caribou migration, they are really spread out. The bugs have died off now with the first hard frost, and really they're free to feed at their own free will for the first time since we started with them on the entire journey. And there's no place they necessarily have to get to, and there's nothing pushing them around except for the odd wolf and bear passing through. And so they're quite dispersed. It wasn't sort of the big throng of the herd that we'd been a part of earlier in the trip, but as we started making our way south, we found ourselves actually accompanied and followed by small groups of caribou for the 3.5 weeks that it took us to get back to Old Crow. And so right to the last few miles of getting back into the village of Old Crow, we're witnessing small bands of caribou swimming the Porcupine River in front and behind us. And so it really was a sort of accompaniment, almost as if they didn't quite want to finish telling us their story in the knowledge that we would hopefully continue and share that story with others when we got back. And in fact, that's what we decided to do, as difficult as it was, once we finished the journey and got to Old Crow and spent time with Randall and some of the other friends that we'd made there for a week, is Leanne and I kind of looked at each other, and certainly the book project and the film project were in the forefront of our minds, and trying to get this out, the story out, and influence and as many people as possible while the issue is still being debated about whether or not to drill in the calving grounds. But we wanted to do something even more immediate. Like, if that didn't seem to be enough, and it wouldn't be realized fast enough for our liking at that time. We were just so passionate and so enthralled and excited by everything we'd learned and everything the caribou shared with us. We felt it was really important to go directly to the place where all the decisions about the future were going to be made, Washington, D.C. So in probably, a journey that was tougher and crazier than anything we'd done yet, we got on a plane in Old Crow, and through a series of 7 stops in airports of increasing size and intensity of human activity, we made our way directly from Old Crow to Washington, D.C. Mm. And that was, to re-immerse ourselves in human society, we knew was going to be difficult no matter how we did it. And certainly a week in Old Crow, even that was difficult in terms of being inside heated houses, to be separated from the outside world, to have the inundation of satellite TV and sort of the chatter of, you know, the latest Hollywood movies bantering around the street alongside the chatter about caribou. Like, we just felt like every moment and step that we took sort of back to our old lives from the ones we'd experienced with the caribou was slowly cutting us off from this incredible way of being that we'd experienced with them, and wanted to continue to nurture and continue to explore. But what was happening was it was being cut off, and the more time we sort of spent sleeping in beds and in comfort and separated, the less we started to, the less we had dreams, visions, and finally, you know, by the time we got to Washington, D.C., and in the shock of suddenly being in subway stations and helicopters flying overhead and their continual surveillance and security guards outside every building and people talking on their ear mics on their cell phones to people that, you know, no one can see, and everybody, you know, looking ahead of, and not even making eye contact. Like, it just, all those things kind of eroded away everything that had taken so long to grow within us, and or not even really eroded away, but began to bury it again. And to the extent that I think the last wild act that either Leanne and I really did was this sort of involuntary act on the way of walking to Capitol Hill from the hotel where we were staying and coming across a vacant lot with some freshly churned dirt in it, and without even realizing it, walking over there searching for caribou tracks. I mean, that's the sort of part of the mental state we were still in. That's how fresh and vulnerable and sensitive we still were. And yet we'd sort of been dropped and plopped into this completely foreign world to anything we'd experienced for the last 5 months. And that was, we knew that was going to be difficult. We knew it was kind of crazy, but it was really important for us to do that, to experience it, because we wanted to witness for ourselves the not only the geographical distance, but also the ideological distance that exists between this caribou herd and all that they stand for, and the place of power, the center of political power, where all the decisions about their future are being made. And that disconnection, I think, is something that we really wanted to experience and articulate firsthand.
I truly believe that this last hour and something is a moment in history for humankind, that strangely enough, the capacity to bring the new technologies and all the new gear and things and put them on humans and allow them to become caribou is something that, as you said, could not have been done before, but it's critical at this time. And in that sense, you've become 21st century shamans. Absolutely. And therefore, I feel you have earned the right to give an informed opinion about ANWR and its future. And I want to give you that opportunity.
Thanks, Sydney. And I think, you know, it's almost like we don't have the language at our disposal to sort of talk about this anymore, to some extent, to talk about what really is at stake in this whole issue of the Arctic refuge. You know, our language is, it's the language of numbers, it's the language of science, it's the language that I was brought up in, that has structured my life. And but when we're out with this caribou herd, you know, that language sort of got silenced over time, and a whole other language started to come out, a whole other way of knowing and being. And when Leanne and I walked into the offices of various senators and members of Congress and spoke, you know, with a few of them, and mostly with their aides, though, in meetings that were hurried, scheduled, and one of dozens that they were having with various lobbyists who were crammed in all their waiting rooms, you know, from everything to the American Automakers Association to Focus on the Family to the whole host and myriad of interests that are out there. And here were two Canadians trying to articulate what had happened on this 5 month journey with the caribou. It was really hard to sort of bridge that ideological distance, I think, in those 5 to 10 minutes that we were allotted in each of those meetings. To the extent that, and we took pictures in, and we really sort of tried to strategize on how we should do it. But ultimately, I think, you know, and I appreciated the bluntness of one particular aide when she said, you know, that it's an amazing journey, it's an amazing story, but the fact of the matter is what our constituencies, what our constituents really care about, what's going to get us voted back into office is, when it comes to this issue, is cheap gas. And I think right then and there, Leanne and I really understood and realized, you know, despite how important it had been for us to go to Washington, D.C. so soon after the trip, our role wasn't to go in and talk to those people in those offices in that center of power. Our role wasn't to try to work from the top down. It really was to share this story of the Caribou with those constituents, with those very people, those very citizens who are communicating that what's really important is cheap gas. Because the cost of gas isn't just in dollars, I guess, is the one thing that we're trying to articulate. The cost of our lives isn't just in the ledger of our bank accounts and our monthly credit card statements. You know, the cost of our lives and the lives we live and the gas we pump into our tanks every time we pull up to the service station is being borne by other things on this planet, things that, you know, aren't just out there in the distance, animals that mean nothing to us, but they're the very source and root of who we are underneath all the technology and all the chatter of modern concerns and false premises of security and that we currently structure our lives around. And so we decided we really need to work from the bottom up and share this story through the film, through the book, through conversations like I'm having with you today, to tell the story of the Caribou so that when people hear about this issue, that they think about more than gas, that they think about more than things like domestic energy security, and that they think about this very Caribou herd that holds the potential to teach us so much about ourselves, so much about the richness and importance, I guess, of being human. And I guess ultimately, you know, if I had to kind of summarize the trip, we called it being Caribou, and certainly that was kind of our goal during the course of the journey, is to come closer to what it is to be one of these wild animals and understanding what it is to migrate with them. But in the end, what I realized is that although we left with this desire to learn more about the wildlife, in the end, what came out of the trip was that the wildlife taught us so much more about ourselves. And so it was a trip about learning to become caribou. But in the end, I think it really was a trip that made us realize what it means to be human.
I believe fully with you that the next role for science is to embrace that communication from the wild back to us, which we've lost. And I believe that you have created, even in this conversation and in all of your work, a truly historic record of the science of spirit. And I encourage people, as you say, if we go to the towers of power, I don't know that that's where these changes will come from. And therefore, I encourage all listeners to pass on this story through the Wildside News and the Voice of the Earth here, because it's important for us to hear this story and to feel it, and as much as possible, share it. It's an incredible moment. I'm honored to be able to have this conversation with you. We've been talking with Carsten Hoyer, who has a book, Being Caribou, published by Mountaineers Books. What can I say? I believe we've said all that we can at this point. just tell people now how they can find out more about your work. Where do you go from here?
Thanks, Sydney, and I really appreciate all you've said, and I also really appreciate the opportunity to share this story with you and all the listeners. The issue about that specifically concerns the porcupine caribou herd, Arctic refuge issue of whether or not to drill for oil and gas on their calving grounds on the coastal plain of Alaska, it continues to evolve, and it continues to get put forth and challenged in various bills. The latest go-around just before Christmas in December 2005 was a couple attempts. One was to attach it to the greater energy and budget bills to go in and allow drilling in Arctic Refuge, which was a very underhanded attempt to open it up because people wouldn't just be voting about the Arctic Refuge. The senators and congressmen were voting about everything from hurricane relief to support for troops in Iraq, all packaged together in one bill. Fortunately, the Arctic Refuge provision for drilling got removed. No sooner had that happened than Senator Stevens from Alaska, in sort of very direct attack on the political, on the Democratic political process, I think, in my mind anyway, attached it to the defense bill. And that, in turn, got defeated at the last moment in the Senate, where they removed it from the defense bill. So I guess the bottom line is, for people who want to have a voice, is to access our website, which is www.beingcaribou.com, where we have updates on the constantly changing political challenges that are being put forth to the Arctic Refuge. And ultimately, we're starting with a number of other groups, because there are many hundreds of conservation groups working on this, where we're starting to put forth a plan that kind of shifts from defense of attacks on the Arctic Refuge to an offensive of getting this last piece of the puzzle, which is the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, protected like the rest of the refuge, which needs to happen, I think, sooner rather than later. So please visit our website. Please stay tuned. And most important of all, please, if you've been moved in any way by this conversation today and what you've heard and the caribou story, because they don't have a voice in our human political process, it's important that you express that voice on their behalf. And so please write, call, talk to your senators, talk to your congressmen. And the one thing I think of anything that I learned while we were in Washington, D.C., is how much those direct attempts by the constituents to articulate their concerns actually does have an effect on what the representatives and senators do on Capitol Hill when they're representing you, the voter. Letters do have power. Phone calls do have a tremendous influence. And the voice of the people ultimately has to be the voice of the politicians. And if that system of communication breaks down or is neglected through things like apathy, and I think our whole great democratic system that is the very foundation of both American and Canadian political systems will degrade and fail.
Carsten Heuer, that's H-E-U-E-R. Your website is beingcaribou.com. Give my regards to Leanne. I hope someday we have a chance to meet. And for those people who wish to become part of this and really, really embrace it, I encourage you to buy the book, quite honestly. Mountaineer's Books, it's available all over the place, Amazon and bookstores and places. And you're also going to be doing tours, and there's movies out. Where can people, they can go to the website, but where do you expect to be in the future here?
Yeah, the website does have a schedule of our speaking engagements I'm at the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C. in early February, the Explorers Club in New York the week after that, and then Salt Lake City, back in Virginia, San Francisco in late February. So really, you know, doing our best right now to really get this story out as widely as possible.
And I believe people can also contact you if they wish to schedule talks and presentations?
Yes, and there's contact information on the website.
Mm-hmm. Carsten Hoyer, thank you so much for for being human at its most powerful, in its most powerful form. I really don't have many words left except to say thank you.
Thank you, Sydney. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Until next time, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.